Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, and it's my first opportunity to come to the Oxford Union, so it's a great pleasure to be here, and rather difficult and dangerous times, so I understand why people have come out on a wet Monday night.
Well, we're speaking, as you say, at a particularly tense time in global politics. As we watch the war in Ukraine progress, is there anything that you feel the general public should be paying attention to that we're not?
Well, we're all, I certainly am glued to the news and following what is happening in Ukraine. And it's a, you know, it is a terrible series of events that we're witnessing. The intelligence machinery, my service, MI6, predicted that this would happen. I was hoping it wouldn't in the end happen because I didn't think it was in President Putin's interest or Russia's interest. And I think he would have a sufficient assessment of where Russia's long-term interests lie not to do this. But I think one of the worrying features of this is that the cold, calculating President Putin that I watched closely for over 20 years, and I met him close up a number of times when I was working with Tony Blair. Blair and Putin had a series of meetings early on in Putin's formative time. And most of them are what we call one plus one. Each leader has a plus one to take a note and to chip in when it might be needed. And I was the plus one for Tony Blair at that stage. And so you got to see Putin really close up. And here was a man who'd stabilized Russia after the chaotic 1990s, who actually in his first couple of years was trying to modernize and reform Russia in a sensible direction. I think the Iraq war set back some of those relations, but what really set it back were the Orange Revolutions the colored revolutions in first Georgia and then Ukraine in 2003, 2004. And he set himself against reform. And he set himself the goal of rebuilding Russia, but with complete tight control at the center and using the revenues from increasing oil price and oil sales and gas sales in order to fund a state that could deliver some services to the Russian people. And then after 2014 and the crisis in Ukraine then and the collapse of the oil price, it changed from being, well, the deal used to be, you leave us in power and we'll deliver growing services to you. They couldn't do that after 2014 because of the state of the Russian economy and the global economy. And increasingly, Putin's deal with the Russian people was, you leave us in power and we will restore Russia's greatness. And you could see where that deal came from, but he still pursued it rationally. And the annexation of Crimea was a clinical, cynical, but effective coup de main, a successful operation that he carried out. The President Putin we've been watching in the last few weeks is a different President Putin. I don't know what's happened to him during the 2 years of COVID, except that he's been incredibly isolated, including from his own advisors and his own officials. And he seems to live in an information bubble. I think he's made a massive error of judgment in his own interests, not only in the interests of Ukraine. I think he's miscalculated how the Ukrainian people would react. And now he's facing a situation where his military are facing really concerted resistance. How President Zelensky, to many people's surprise, is providing brave and inspiring leadership to the Ukrainian people. And the weight of sanctions that have been brought to bear on Russia is vastly greater than President Putin and those around him would have expected. So I think we're now in a situation where President Putin is on the back foot. Now, that doesn't mean he's going to lose the war in Ukraine. Brave though the Ukrainian resistance is, the fact is the Russians have got immensely powerful armed forces and will be able to take Kharkiv and Kiev even at the cost of destroying them. And there's that famous quote from an American major in the Vietnam War: we had to destroy the village in order to take it, in order to save it. And but one has this horrible sense that even though Kiev is the cradle of Russian civilization, in many ways Putin is right to describe it as that, there's a risk of destroying Kiev in order to occupy it. And that would be, you know, an absolutely terrible outcome for this. But it would be entirely President Putin's fault. This is President Putin's war. It's Putin's war, this. So what am I watching for? I'm watching for how fast the Russians advance inside Ukraine, and there's a mixed picture there. How far they go, how far west they go. The further west they go, the more resistance they will meet, and the greater the risk of a clash on the borders between Russia and NATO countries like Poland, Hungary, Romania, and so on. I'm looking to see what the political reaction in Moscow is, and looking to see what the impact of sanctions might be. One of the things I do in my afterlife from public service is I sit on the board of BP. And you'll have seen the news over the last couple of days of the big decision we took to exit Russia. Now, some might say, well, why were you there in the first place? Well, we were there in the first place because it was a very good investment to make, and it produced excellent returns for shareholders over 25 years, 23 years or something. But it became impossible to be there. And although it was a costly decision, it wasn't a difficult decision because there was no alternative. And we're seeing Equinor followed yesterday. Shell have just followed this evening. I saw in the news before I came in here. The Russian ruble is collapsing, and the level of resistance, not resistance, opposition in Russia is growing. But that said, I think it's important that we leave a way out for Putin from this crisis. If we trap him in a corner and he feels his whole existence is at threat as leader of the Russian regime, then that is a very dangerous time for us all. We saw him fiddling with nuclear alert levels on Sunday, and that was a warning to us. I think it's really important. This is a dangerous time. The dangerous time across Europe. It's really important this doesn't become a conflict between NATO and Russia. And Putin can't turn it into an issue where it looks as though we are battling against Russia. What we're doing is we're supporting Ukraine in its independence and its self-determination and in its sovereignty. And that's the battleground we have to stay on. And it has to be a battleground which, whilst we support the Ukrainian armed forces in their resistance, we do not step across the line and engage Russia directly in conflict, because that would raise the level of tensions and threat vastly higher.
And how effective do you think economic sanctions and discussions with Russia will be in the coming weeks?
Well, I'm not hopeful about the early negotiations. And there's that meeting that took place on the Ukraine-Belarus border today. The Russians sent as their head of delegation an extreme nationalist historian who was there to, I suspect, read the Ukrainians a lecture. I suspect he was the man who influenced President Putin in his essay last July about Ukraine, which some of you may have read. So I don't expect much progress from that. But it's good that Zelensky wants to be able to talk. And although President Macron has sort of positioned himself as a sort of savior of Europe or representative of Europe on this, actually, the fact that he's talking to President Putin, and he spoke again to Putin this today, I think that's a good thing that is going on. But the fact is, the Russian demands are for an unconditional surrender of Ukraine, the resignation of the Zelensky government, and Ukrainian recognition of Crimea as being part of Russia. There's absolutely no way that those negotiable demands for a Ukrainian government. And what the West is supporting is the elected Ukrainian government deciding Ukraine's future. Now, there are some issues where there's scope for movement. And the reality is that that whilst Ukraine wants to become a member of NATO, there's no realistic prospect of it becoming a member of NATO. And then can you use that fact in a negotiation with Russia to address one of the Russian concerns? The answer is, I think you probably can with skillful diplomacy, but it is difficult to deploy skillful diplomacy when you've got shells and missiles and tanks, you know, rolling around your capital, and you're under that level of duress. So I think the sanctions, which are of an unprecedented level, we used to save the most extreme financial sanctions for global pariahs like North Korea or Iran when we were trying to get them to give up their nuclear weapons aspirations. And we still are, of course. Thank you, Donald Trump, for messing that one up. These sanctions, the freezing of the central bank of Russia's assets, these are very far-reaching sanctions which are having a direct impact on the Russian economy. You're seeing the stock market has tanked, the ruble has collapsed in value, ordinary Russians can't get money out of their cash machines. This is going to play into reactions on the streets of Moscow and other Russian cities really quite quickly. And so how that plays into the debates, such as they are within the government system, we'll have to watch very closely, and they'll be all behind closed doors. But I think it is important that we allow these pressures to come to bear. As I saw in South Africa, the main sanctions against South Africa started in 1977. It wasn't actually until 12 years later that the process of change began in South Africa, the serious change began in South Africa. The real economic pressures started in the mid-80s after the riots and in Soweto and other townships, and the brutal suppression of them by the regime. Sanctions take a time. I don't believe anyone thinks that these sanctions by themselves will change Putin's mind. He's not going to say, oh, I can't do this, I now need to withdraw. But they are posing a price. They're affecting perceptions and attitudes inside Russia, amongst the Russian elite. And one of the values of sanctions is that when a leader decides that they do want to negotiate, the easing of those sanctions becomes a motive. One of the big motives in South Africa was allowing rugby teams and cricket teams to play against South Africans. Now, you may not be very interested in sport, but it meant a big thing for a lot of South African males who were otherwise quite resistant to the process of change. In Iran, when I negotiated with Iran in the early years of the nuclear deal, the prospect of easing economic sanctions was massively attractive to the Iranians, and still is. That's their main motive for negotiating a return by the Americans to the nuclear deal. So there's sanctions have a certain effect straight away, but they're not so much a political effect. Their political effect comes later, once their real impact has sunk in, and the economies and lifestyles of the leadership, ideally, rather than the people of the country. But they're a pretty blunt instrument, I'm afraid, sanctions. But they do have an effect. And I've witnessed in South Africa, in Serbia, in the Balkans wars, in Libya over their weapons of mass destruction, in Iran over their nuclear program. And to some extent, China adjusts its response in order to minimize sanctions or to avert sanctions. So sanctions can be an important weapon, but they're blunt and they're slow in effect.
And do you think the UK could have done more to prevent the escalation of the current crisis?
I think President Putin was set on this for some months. I wouldn't have said that a month ago, because I thought that it was still possible that he could have used this force that he gathered around Ukraine's borders for coercive diplomacy, to extract concessions from Ukraine, extract concessions from the West, force Ukraine down a path that was more amenable to Russian interests. But the harsh reality is, looking back on Putin's actions of the last 2 weeks or so, was that he had this in mind all along. There perhaps might have been more that we could have done to prepare for it, to help prepare the Ukrainians for it. But I don't think, even a week before the invasion began, President Zelensky and his government were urging the Americans to calm the temperature. No, this isn't going to happen. We need to keep things as normal as possible. And to the government's credit, it has done well to provide defense aid, lethal material to the Ukrainian armed forces to help them defend themselves. I'm sure some of those Russian tanks that are lying in the gutter of Ukraine's roads are there because of some of the weapons that have been provided to the Ukrainian forces over the last period. And I think the global sanctions effort, I think, has surprised everybody. And initially, and most of you won't understand, and I don't really understand how the international financial trading system works, but this SWIFT mechanism in Brussels, where it's a messaging system for clearing financial transactions, there was an agreement between the EU and the US just to leave that alone, just let the Russians do some basic business through the SWIFT mechanism in order so that Germany could pay for its gas and that you could do the bare minimum. But it quickly became a sort of touchstone as to whether your sanctions were serious enough. And excluding Russian banks from the SWIFT mechanism, freezing the central bank's assets, have had this massive impact. I'm sure the Chinese are watching this very carefully indeed, this sort of new generation of sanctions that are being introduced now.
Well, I'm keen to leave some time for audience questions. If you have a question, if you could raise your membership card, and we will come round with a microphone.
Raise your membership card. There's a challenge.
Well, and the member just at the front here in black puffer.
Obviously, you've said that it's very important that this doesn't become a battle directly between NATO and Russia. But do you think it is appropriate and that there is room for some more clandestine operations directly in support of Ukraine? Obviously, we have MI6, we have offensive cyber capabilities within the intelligence community. Do you think there is space to deploy those without it escalating further to better support openly Ukraine?
Well, that's a brilliant question, and you've got a future in the security services. But it's the sort of question which, obviously, I find very difficult to answer. And I hope you understand the reasons for that. I think it's really important that, as I said in my earlier remarks, we don't allow President Putin to present this as the West trying to topple his regime, because that then becomes an existential question for Russia. And some of the things you're implying would get pretty damn close to that. The one thing about clandestine operations is they always become known at some point. So you can't keep things clandestine forever. And the second thing I would say is, yes, there are a variety of things that we can do to support the extraordinary bravery of the Ukrainians at a human level, the military, at the leadership level, as they go through this. And I think a lot of the things that we're doing is very much supportive of that. But President Putin, in one of his interviews, tells quite a revealing story about his own childhood, about how he lived in a block of a ghastly block of flats in one of the poorer areas of Leningrad, as it was then, St. Petersburg, as it is now. And he used to chase rats around the stairwell. And one day, he got a rat, and he got it in a corner. Now, it may have been invented, this story, but this is the story he tells. He got a rat in the corner, and he trapped it. And the next thing he knew, the rat had flown out and hit him in the face, scratched him, and escaped. And his lesson was, never corner a rat. Well, I don't know if he was referring to himself, but there's a certain lesson in there for us, that if you corner someone who's incredibly dangerous, somewhat irrational, and has got nuclear weapons at the end of his fingertips, we need to be a little bit careful how we do that. So we must leave Putin a way out of this in due course, we mustn't allow him to think that this is an existential system, existential crisis for his regime. That's a matter for Russians to sort out. It's not a matter for us to determine those issues. What we can do to support the Ukrainians, there'll be a spectrum of things that we can do. I'm not going to get into the realm of speculating on the things that you were talking about. But clearly, the whole spirit, the morale of the sentiment of the British people, the British government, strongly behind the Ukrainian people, and rightly so. And that's where our commitment will lie.
And I'll take a question from the member just in the yellow at the back there.
Can you stand up so we can see you?
Yes.
Hi, good evening. You mentioned that sanctions are primarily a tool of politics and negotiations whose effects are seen at a later date. And you also told us the tale of how one mustn't corner a rat. With this in mind, hypothetically, what do you think the next step is should Putin increase or continue his march into Ukraine? And following that, what do you think of China's current position as well?
Well, I think the Russian forces will continue their march into Ukraine. They are vastly outnumber Ukrainian forces. They've got heavy artillery, which I think we will see more of. And there are reports of, there are reports of low morale and motivation amongst a lot of the Russian conscripts who are doing this fighting. But there's also disturbing rumours that Chechen irregulars are being brought in to do the dirty work that Russian troops might balk at. So I think we do need to brace ourselves for further violence in Ukraine. And ultimately, I think most military analysts would say we should expect the Russian forces to prevail. But they will be having to occupy a country which is almost united in opposition to what the Russians are doing and will put up a very severe fight. President Putin has used some rather, to us, astonishing language, accusing Ukrainians of being Nazis, and he wants to denazify Ukraine. I think he's remembering a distorted version of what happened after World War II, in that after the and the Ukrainians, a bit like the Finns in this regard, they were faced with two evils. They had the Germans on one hand and they had the Russians on the other hand. And it wasn't clear which side was a bigger danger to their long-term national struggle. But after 1945, it was very clear to Ukrainians that the bigger opposition came, bigger obstacle was the Russians, the Soviets. And there was a civil war in the west of what is now the west of Ukraine for their independence, in which about 100,000 people were killed as the Ukrainians fought against the Soviets. And because some of them had worked with the Nazis as well, the Russians accused all of them of being Nazis. Actually, they were Ukrainian nationalists. So there's a history here, but it's a distorted history that President Putin is recalling. I expect there to be I think it's reasonable to expect that after a bloody war, which will last several weeks yet, the Russian armed forces will prevail, but that there will be a sustained opposition and insurgency by the Ukrainians against that Russian occupation. I hope it doesn't. I hope the Ukrainians stand their ground, but I think it would be wishful thinking to think that they're going to be able to prevent the Russians imposing themselves on certain Ukrainian cities and basically forcing the ousting of the Zelensky government from Kiev. So that would be my expectation. But in wars, they never go as planned. You can never predict how they're going to run their course. And politics back home can change what happens on the battlefield. There are those complications. Should I take the China question now?
Yes, do. Yeah.
I think this is very interesting, the China dimension. and this is awkward for China, because by far the biggest issue in the world for China is their rivalry, strategic rivalry with the United States. And Russia is a sort of is a useful partner to China in that endeavor. And they face some of the same challenges. They want to close down freedom of information, both China and Russia. They want to make themselves less susceptible to financial pressure and the power of the dollar. And they want to be able to run their autocratic systems without being constantly hectored about their appalling human rights performances. And so China and Russia have got a number of sort of common interests in here. But China also firmly believes in national sovereignty, territorial integrity, and not intervening violently in another country, in another country next door to you. And they do that for their own purposes. They don't want anyone claiming Tibet is independent or preventing them in due course trying to reintegrate Taiwan with the mainland. It's to govern their views on Hong Kong as well for the last 50 years before and after the handover. So the Chinese have got strong views on those principles and they want to protect them as well. I used to deal with the Chinese a lot when I was in the Security Council. Obviously, the Chinese were one of the P5. And you've several times felt them to be sort of rolling their eyes at what the Russians were doing because the Chinese were much more skillful, much more thoughtful, and were longer term and were less brutal. I think the Chinese leadership, they look back at the Brezhnev era and they see a failure to modernize and rejuvenate the Communist Party, which led to its demise. They see the way President Gorbachev tried to bring in economic reform and political reform at the same time and failed because it led to the collapse of the system. And I think they might now be looking at President Putin and thinking, here's a third Russian leader making a mistake of strategic proportions. And they will be studying what's happening on the battlefield. They'll be studying carefully this new generation of sanctions that they do not want to get caught up in or be subject to. And if there's one silver lining to the cloud of what's happening in Ukraine, I think those people who worry about a Chinese attack on an invasion of Taiwan, I think that's even less likely now in the near future than it was before. And we can go into more China discussion if any of you want to do that. But I think the Chinese will be following this very carefully. They'll be a bit embarrassed by what the Russians are doing. But the biggest issue for them will be the ongoing prosecution of their competition and rivalry with the United States.
We have time for one more very brief question. I'll take it from the member at the back just here.
Usually end these things on a light-hearted note, but it's quite hard to do that on an occasion like this.
Hello, thank you for your speech. It was very, very good. So as someone who's built an esteemed career on information and intelligence, I'm curious, how do you get your news?
That's an interesting point, because I stepped down from MI6 and from the government at the end of 2014, and I did wonder what I would do without the flow of intelligence reports and diplomatic cables and privileged meetings with counterparts and leaders from other countries who would beat a path to the MI6 door. But actually, I found that a lot of the information that I was getting at that time is incredibly detailed. And I used to talk about Syria earlier. I used to know every damn village in Syria and all the terrorist units and the different areas where they were operating. Sort of information which, frankly, now is not a great help. There is a fantastic range of open source material. During COVID, one of the benefits of COVID was that instead of traveling to America or traveling to Singapore or traveling to Berlin or whatever, I could attend a meeting in Singapore in the morning, meeting in Berlin at lunchtime, a meeting in London at tea time. At 9 o'clock at night, I'd attend something in New York or San Francisco. And it was a fantastic liberation in that sense, in that my network of that I built up over the years, many of whom are my own generation, so we're sort of beyond government now, but we could communicate and learn from younger people who are still in government. And people are interested, and I do a number of advisory, I have a number of advisory roles, helping people understand the world in which they're operating, the tough business decisions they have to take, how they deal with their investments in China, how they manage Saudi Arabia. Bliss will not talk about Saudi Arabia in a gathering like this. What I do is obviously, you read the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post and the Economist and various other things every day and every week. You keep your network of communications, and you have, in my case, over 40 years' experience of operating in this world and being able to build on that. So I feel I've got a privileged starting point. If someone wants to talk about Kashmir, well, I haven't thought about Kashmir for a long time, but I do remember negotiations on Kashmir between the Indians and the Pakistanis, and I can clock back into that. I know where the starting point is of the Indians and the Pakistanis when they start negotiating on that. And that is true of a lot of very long-standing conflicts like Cyprus or Ethiopia and other parts of the world, Middle East. And it also means that you can get your head around new conflicts really quite quickly, because you know how governments respond, you know how politics change, you know the uncertainty of the battlefield, and you have some experience. We're talking about sanctions. I've dealt with sanctions all my life in different environments, and I've seen what's effective and what's not effective. I've seen the timescale they take. I see the side effects, which are sometimes very painful, of a sanctions-based policy. But you can apply that to a new situation like Ukraine. So none of you have even 40 years of life, let alone 40 years of experience, but you will. Life passes. But if I was to leave you with a thought, and that is that engaging in the world is fantastically important, especially now when there are so many problems. We're not talking about climate change this evening. It's another whole dimension of international life, which is a real challenge that we're all facing and your generation will face above any. We're facing the challenges of technology. We're facing challenges of strategic rivalry. We're facing the challenge of finding a new role for Britain after what I think was a mistaken decision to leave the European Union, but we've done it now. We've got to find a new role for ourselves outside the European Union where we can play a part in extending our values and keeping dangers at a distance from us, which is the essence, really, of our security. You don't want your security to be on the White Cliffs of Dover. You want the security to be 1,000 miles away, so that you can operate freely and our people can go about their lives in freedom and with one hopes growing prosperity. And that's what public service is about. And I hope I've left you with the thought that my own personal experience of public service has been not financially rewarding, but immensely spiritually rewarding. And there's also an afterlife when you work slightly less hard and get paid a bit more. So that's nice too.
Well, Sir John, thank you so much for joining us. What a wonderful opportunity to speak to you today. Please join me in thanking Sir John for his
thank you, Molly.